Nacholand Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Thursday episode of the Calcioland podcast. With the Christmas holiday coming, Alex and I are recording a day early. I really appreciate all of Alex's efforts this year. You know, another year that we've done the pod together. It's been really, really awesome. That's one of the reasons that keeps me going is these chats with Alex. So we'll talk to him at the top about De Ligt. I have a lot of thoughts on De Ligt. I'm very curious to hear Alex's thoughts on the beginning of Conte's tenure at Spurs. I have a couple of thoughts on that as well. And we have an excellent interview with our dear friend, the Napoli Outsider. We wanted to close out the year with him. I will just warn you, we recorded the interview, and you'll hear on this pod the part on Napoli before the match against Spezia, which in retrospect, I wish we hadn't. But this time of year, everyone's so busy, it's hard to record. So please bear with us, but I think it'll be an excellent show. And of course, we'll get to our patrons with a special part of the pod there. But I want to talk about De Ligt. I have a lot of thoughts. It's a very interesting situation, and I'm very excited to talk about this with our friend Alex Goldberg, because he's kind of the perspective a little bit outside of Serie A. So I always like to get his thoughts on this. So let's look at it this way. Last week, Raiola announced that De Ligt would probably be moving on in the summer, that it was time to take the next step, mentioned some clubs in specific. So there's been a lot of buzz on this happening. To recap, Juve acquired De Ligt a few years ago, well before COVID, for over 70 million. As part of that deal, they included an exit clause for 150 million, which goes into effect. And we're going to talk all about the financials when I get to my part, but I'm really more interested in hearing Alex's thoughts on a few topics. So let's start with this one first, Alex, because obviously when De Ligt arrived at Juve, was incredibly highly rated. He was the captain of Ajax. They had made that superb run to the Champions League semifinal. I view De Ligt as kind of potentially a generational talent defender, but his tenure at Juve has been uneven, unfortunate. I think he's been good, but not great, which is what Juve expected. So I want to ask you this, Alex. How would you say fans that aren't totally immersed in Serie A and have been following De Ligt at Juve, their struggles in the Champions League, how would you say they compared him, say, to Koulibaly a few years ago? Since we've started this podcast, you know, we've talked so many times of Koulibaly potentially leaving. He was kind of seen as this amazing defender. And then the other one I want to ask you as a comp is Ruben Dias, obviously been excellent at Man City. So what would you say De Ligt is viewed compared to Koulibaly a few years ago and Ruben Dias now?
Yeah, it's a great question, David, because it's really important for me to quickly separate how I feel and perceive De Ligt rather than, of course, maybe your average Premier League fan. And if I'm thinking of an average Premier League fan, they're probably not paying as much attention to what the narrative is on De Ligt within Serie A. Whereas, of course, I do a Serie A podcast with you once a week, and obviously I'm part of this show behind the scenes twice a week. So I have a decent idea of how a Juve fan and just a Serie A fan views De Ligt these days. But to get to the immediate comparisons and answering those immediate comparisons, I think you'll get my take and hopefully the average Premier League fan's take on De Ligt. I think compared to the way Koulibaly was spoken about a couple years ago, I don't think he's as sought after. And David, I think that's because of what you mentioned. When De Ligt was leaving Ajax, he was kind of widely regarded as like the can't-miss prospect, the can't-miss young defender, not just of that time, of that year, but maybe of the last handful of years. Like, I hadn't really known, at least in my time following football, of a young defender that was outside the top five leagues that was being spoken about almost in a blank check manner, especially a defender. I mean, maybe there are some attackers, but that's different, right? Because attackers are normally the sexier, more desirable signing, especially if they're young, for the average fan. But the way De Ligt carried himself at Ajax, the fact that he was captain as a teenager, and then obviously what Ajax did in the Champions League, I mean, it put him on this pedestal, David, where if he didn't replicate that at Juve, that exact same thing at Juve, no matter what, there are going to be fans who are like, ah, never mind. He's just not as good. Maybe we overhyped him. Maybe he's a bust. And then compared to Koulibaly a couple years ago, finished article, right? In his prime. And anybody who was thinking about getting Koulibaly was thinking, okay, this guy immediately slots in as one of our most important players and one of our best players. And really, I don't know if he was being spoken about as write a blank check for him, because he was obviously of the age of he's in his prime. And usually you say that for a younger player, the whole blank check thing. But I mean, there were many fans who wanted to spend quite a bit of money on Koulibaly. And you know what? At one point in time, I think I was definitely one of them. So compared to Koulibaly from a couple seasons ago, I think there's a little less shine on De Ligt to the average Premier League fan. There's a butt coming, but now let's go to Ruben Dias. I also think there's a little less shine on De Ligt compared to how Ruben Dias is rated now, even though if you ask some Premier League fans, they think Ruben Dias is supremely overrated and that, yes, he had a good season, well, arguably a great season last campaign, but that he also may have been pushed by the media to be all that good. There were many times where Chelsea players left him on the ground, and there were many times he was left on the ground by many players. But no, obviously, he had a very good season. He was a highly rated young center back before he got to Manchester City. So overall, he is rated quite high, especially for young defenders. But because he's in the Premier League, I think fans, like I was just kind of mentioning, can see the pros and the cons. And there is this alert of foreign players. So De Ligt would count as that because he hasn't been in the Premier League yet. But of course, I think the fact that Ruben Dias is Premier League tested would make him rated higher than De Ligt. So I just said to you that Koulibaly of a couple years ago and Ruben Dias now would both be viewed in a bit of a shinier way than De Ligt now. But it's not that much worse, though, for De Ligt. It isn't, because I think most Premier League fans still know that he's very young. He's very young because they knew that he was supremely young at Ajax. And also, I think that if the average Premier League fan has been somewhat paying attention, they don't have to listen to Calcioland every week or be following all these Serie A accounts, but I think they know De Ligt hasn't necessarily, he certainly hasn't been a bust, but he also hasn't necessarily reached that height because of lack of talent. He's had injuries. And also, Juve have not been the team that they were for so long. So I think that they give De Ligt some points there. Kind of like how if a player went to Manchester United a handful of years ago, like even Lukaku, they don't get all the blame because Manchester United were so dysfunctional. And I'm not saying Juve have been completely dysfunctional, but De Ligt did not come into that steady ship that was Juve. I mean, maybe he did like right away, but that quickly started sinking. So I think slack is cut for De Ligt in many departments. His age cuts some slack. The fact that injuries have been there. But also, like, I don't want to say anything incorrect here, David, but I feel like his injuries are not viewed as a huge red flag because, correct me if I'm wrong, some have been upper body, right? He's had a shoulder thing and everything like that. So usually the upper body injuries are not as concerning long term than lower body injuries. So you know, I feel like he gets some slack there. And the fact that Juve have not been that steady team, they've gone through, what, three managers since he's been there? So I feel like even the average Premier League fan knows kind of this context and still would look at De Ligt compared to many other center backs in other leagues at that age and say, you know what, I'd go for him. He's got great talent. Can play in a back three or a back four. And he's still a young leader, right? That doesn't change. He still has the intangibles. So yeah, maybe not as shiny of a toy as what Koulibaly was viewed a couple years ago and what Ruben Dias is viewed now, but not that far off because once again, the context is certainly different than the Koulibaly situation still being much younger. And the Ruben Dias one, it's like, all right, one's right in front of us on a week-to-week basis, one's not. But yeah, I still think he'd be one of the more sought after young center backs from another league that would come into the Premier League. So for me personally, I would rosy it up a bit more. I know you asked for the average Premier League perspective, but I would even rosy it up a bit more. I still would view him as one of the top young center backs that I'd want to acquire if I wanted to acquire a top young center back. I happen to really like the ones that Chelsea already own, like someone like Trevor Chalobah, and we got another young one on loan in the championship. But yeah, I think the shine should still be fully on him. But I even think Premier League fans, like, I don't see the word bust all that often, to really make a long answer a lot shorter. I think serious fans know that he's far from a bust. So, yeah, David, that's my take.
Well said. So let's talk a little bit more about the fit at Chelsea. And this isn't really so much because I feel a lot of these apply to other clubs. So we're going to make it a little more Chelsea, obviously, because that's your neck of the woods. They obviously are one of the clubs that can afford them. But we're going to go over some factors and think about it, too, if this applies to the club you support or a club you think he could go to. So we know, you know, you have Thiago Silva, who's older, Christensen, probably going to sign a contract. Rudiger, who could leave on a Bosman. So, and you mentioned Chelsea does have these other good center backs. So let's just look at the financial side. So obviously Juve is going to want to get big return. They invested a lot on him. De Ligt's probably not as valuable as he was when he was at Ajax. But do you envision Chelsea being willing to spend a huge sum transfer fee? And I think the most underrated thing on the whole De Ligt aspect is the wages. And I think this is something not talked about enough. And this was also true about Donnarumma, because the problem, and I put this in air quotes, was it's not a problem for them, is when you have such a young player who is paid essentially like a superstar in his prime. So they are paid as if they were that finished product that you said Koulibaly was. So De Ligt is right now, I think, probably the highest paid player in Serie A, or he's very close to it, and he's very young, and obviously he's going to want raises. So do you think Chelsea would be willing to make the big financial investment that comes both for the transfer fee and especially the wages?
It's possible. It is possible because, first of all, Roman Abramovich is a very ambitious man. I think we know that. And I still think he wants to do something in response to losing someone like Antonio Rudiger. Obviously, Chelsea used their academy more. And man, if Mason Mount and Reece James didn't prove why you should use your academy more, I think Trevor Chalobah is doing it this season, especially since he's truly a center back. And he's been absolutely phenomenal. So there's a huge willingness from top to bottom now to use the academy. But still, this is Chelsea, and I know Roman is always going to also want to have the signings, especially when a Rudiger leaves and when the fan base has become so close to someone like Rudiger. And it's been widely reported that what Rudiger wants isn't that egregious financially, but Chelsea have kind of drawn a line in the sand and they're not going to go any further. I think almost even from an optics standpoint, Roman would want to do something in that department. Probably not multiple center backs, but we've heard rumors now of Jules Koundé for a while. I mean, he almost did come to Chelsea in the summer. Seems like he really wanted to. And it does seem like Chelsea, at least on one center back, are willing to spend a decent amount, especially if they're young, but also have some experience because they have a manager in Tuchel who can really coach players up. And it's a young team, so they want players they can build around, but also players that, you know, won't look completely poor right upon arriving. You know, they want players who obviously have been in Europe for a little while. Koundé and De Ligt would check those boxes. You know, they've obviously had a decent amount of experience for club and country, even though they're young. So if it wasn't Koundé, I wouldn't be surprised at all if it was De Ligt. I mean, I know personally that Chelsea certainly have been scouting and looking at De Ligt for a little while. Then again, you could say that for really every top club in Europe, probably. But I wouldn't be surprised, David, with the financials, because I think it would be kind of advertised as, okay, we're putting a lot of money into getting De Ligt between getting him and obviously his salary and everything like that. But we will then maybe give Levi Colwill a chance to be promoted. And he's the center back I mentioned from the championship. So kind of like a signing and a academy player to balance out the scale there. And yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all, David. I mean, I would be surprised if we got Koundé and then we got De Ligt, because I think that would just be too much in finances. You want to allocate in different spots. And I think Chelsea are trying to do that these days. But no, if Koundé didn't happen, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Chelsea made a strong push for De Ligt.
And you don't think the Raiola thing would be discouraged? I think a while ago, I forget, maybe it was months ago, you mentioned that Chelsea had started talking a little bit with Raiola again. Do you see that as a big hurdle? Because I think there are some clubs that would just not deal with him. Like I think Bayern Munich, in a lot of ways, would be a club that I could see trying to sign a player like De Ligt, but I think the agent would turn him off. We know there's some other clubs like PSG definitely love to play ball with him. We know even Barcelona have started to rekindle talks with him. Do you think that Ayala factor would be very discouraging to Chelsea or not at all?
Well, it's always a caution, but I did say, like you mentioned, I said this past summer that I was hearing from a wide variety of people privately that Chelsea were coming to the conclusion, and of course, this was spearheaded by the approach for Erling Haaland, but they were coming to the conclusion that, you know what? Fine, we won the Champions League, but in a way, it's actually harder to win the Premier League because it's a longer season. It's more games. Manchester City and Liverpool have set this bar so absurdly high. And even though, of course, we won the Champions League, I mean, look at where we've been finishing the last 4 seasons in the Premier League. So many points off these two teams. And the conclusion from inside Chelsea was, you know what? If we want to be consistently contending for the Premier League again and really be viewed in that bracket with City and Liverpool, we can't have this attitude towards a certain agent that keeps us from getting big horses that can help us win titles. So, of course, that was in response to Erling Haaland, who might be still, I mean, he still has to be the most attractive player available to any club in any position. But yeah, if they're willing to kind of break down a small wall for Haaland in terms of having to deal with Raiola, I think they're at least going to sniff around it, and they have been sniffing around it with De Ligt. I'm not sure they'd want to have a bunch of Raiola clients on board because I don't think they want a lot of Raiola in their life. But yeah, I no longer think it's this thing where it's like, oh, Raiola's the agent? No thanks. Because I do think they realize that it's going to be easier to contend in all competitions consistently if they don't have this pre-decided stance that no, if that person's represented by Raiola, we are not going to even go for them. Because David, honestly, like, look at other sports. You can't really have that attitude towards a Drew Rosenhaus or a Scott Boras in baseball. Like, you can't really have that because guess what? Those guys represent a lot of stars, like a lot of stars. If you're an NFL fan, go look up who's represented by a shark in Drew Rosenhaus, who's absolutely annoying beyond belief, or a Scott Boras in baseball. Like, it's hard to put together, unless you're one of these cute and clever teams like the Tampa Bay Rays or the Giants, who just don't have a lot of money and you have to do it in a really analytical way. It's really hard to have a competitive team if you have this pre-decided stance that you're not going to deal with a certain agent. I know in football it is different because, my God, you're dealing with even more players, more agents, different countries, etc. But let's face it, Raiola represents some of the absolute best people in the world. So, hey, if at the end of the day that's your tiebreaker to not go for someone, fair play. But I don't think Chelsea have this stance anymore of, oh, they're represented by Raiola. All right, we're not dealing with them. So, all right, David, that's obviously my take on how I would view the possibility of De Ligt to Chelsea, how I view De Ligt, Raiola, etc. So let's talk about the Juve angle of it. I'm only covering it from a Premier League, a Chelsea perspective. What's the Juve angle here?
A lot to unpack. So I'm going to end it on a positive, I promise, because there is one big positive looking at it from Juve's perspective. And again, I'm pretty aware of my biases. I know sometimes it could really come off that I'm overly harshly critical with Juve. So keep that in mind. I'm aware of that, and maybe there is a little bit to that. But in any event, let's look at it. So when Juve signed De Ligt, and I think the reason they signed De Ligt is they knew that replacing Chiellini was going to be incredibly tough. I've said it many times. I think for Juve, moving on from Chiellini is going to be harder than it was from Del Piero and Buffon. I don't mean to say that Chiellini is as good as those two players, but for what he represents at the club, the state at the club where they're at right now, like when Del Piero left, that was right when Juve was on their way. way up. The Conte revolution had begun. When Buffon left, I mean, they had started to phase him out. That had already brought in Szczesny, then Buffon returned. So I know when Juve signed De Ligt, they had a glaring need in the midfield, but they also knew that losing Chiellini eventually was going to be very tough. So they were like, you know what, let's bring in him now, De Ligt now, he can learn from Chiellini and we can groom him. So if he leaves, that goes out the window and that's a problem. In addition to that, Bonucci isn't getting any younger either. I think Bonucci has one, two very good years left in him, is probably the best case scenario. So all of a sudden you find yourself, your two starting center backs gone. In addition to that, Romero is already at Spurs. Atalanta has an option to buy Demiral. Now, in fairness to Juve, I personally don't think Demiral is ever going to be good enough to really be a starter for Juve that we can talk about as someone that can replace Chiellini or Bonucci. A lot of people disagree. I respect their opinion. So I'm not going to kill him on the Demiral thing. But there's no doubt that they are very thin now at center back. So, you know, Chiellini is going to stay on next year with an eye towards the World Cup. Hopefully Italy goes there. But you can't really count on Chiellini being a full-time starter. So huge need there. Juve already has huge needs in the midfield, which we know, and they have a huge need for a goal scorer. So you could say, okay, they can sell De Ligt. They can do essentially what Maggi did with Zidane, and you basically flip him, and then you try, and then you bring in three players, and Juve flips Zidane, and they turn him into Buffon, Thuram, Nedved. Is Juve going to be able to do this now? I don't know. I think the market for De Ligt with COVID is a big impact. Clubs just aren't as flush with cash. There are less team that could sign him. And I would say his value is probably not as high as it was at Ajax. I mean, you know, can Juve get back what they spent on him? Maybe, but I certainly don't see a world in which there's a club that spends 150 million to acquire him, because I just don't think it makes sense. I think in the market they're probably better options at a better price. So, and the other thing, and this is something a lot of Juve fans have pointed out, that the club has lost much better players for the club in recent years, you know, and we say recent years. I mean, we can go back to the 90s. Baggio, the best Italian forward of my lifetime, he left. Zidane, who I think is one of the best players I've ever seen, those guys left Juve. And you could make a case that both Pogba and Vidal, and I think it's fair to say, were better players at Juve than De Ligt has been. But the difference is, you know, Juve has a huge need at that center back position. And when you look at the situation Juve is in right now, De Ligt is exactly the type of player you would want Juve to buy. Young, that can grow, leadership, can kind of take the mantle from the defenders. When Baggio was sold, Juve had Del Piero in the wings. When Zidane was sold, yeah, that was painful, but it's not so painful if then you get one of the greatest keeper of all time. You get Nedved, who won a Ballon d'Or at Juve, and you get Thuram, who's been one of the best defenders in Serie A when he was playing. So to me, that's very different. And I get that, oh, Juve's lost better players, but that's pretty significant if he were to leave now. But here's the silver lining, and this goes back to the wages, is, you know, he does cost a lot. Now, I know a lot of people quote this 12 million net salary. I'm not so sure it's exactly that quite yet. I think that salary goes up throughout the years in the contract, and the first few years not that high, and a lot of it is tied to bonuses. And I just don't know, with the way Juve, the way they've underachieved, how many of these he's actually hit. But it's still a lot of money. There is a world in which Juve could be paying two center backs essentially what the annual cost of De Ligt is, between his amortization, which is sky high. They spent a lot to acquire him, and his huge wages. There is absolutely a world in which Juve, okay, they're not as good as De Ligt, but they have two very good center backs for the price of De Ligt. Does that maybe make more sense for Juve? You could talk me into that. And again, the thing with Raiola clients, unless you're really, really incredibly deep with money, you know that eventually they are going to leave or they're going to want these huge raises. And I go back to the fact that De Ligt right now earns as if he was a finished product superstar. So, you know, and he's very young. So maybe this is a player that eventually Juve in this situation can afford and are in a better position to have two young center backs that are cheaper. But, you know, and I look at it more big picture. This would be a big loss for Serie A. We're also hearing a lot of buzz on Milinkovic-Savic potentially leaving. It won't be in January. So in that sense, it's definitely concerning. We go back to seeing Serie A as a transition league. But before we move on to our patrons, Alex, I do want to ask you about our friend Antonio Conte. I see Spurs fans are really happy with him. So let me just ask you, what do you make of Conte so far at Spurs and the fact of what he's done so far? Changed at all how you view him?
Nope, not at all. I mean, I'm not surprised by this, David. I feel like we kind of predicted this, didn't we? This is what happens when Conte takes over a team. No one is ever going to sit here, even if they've done 1,000 rants on Conte or just made fun of him 1,000 times like myself. No one is ever going to sit here, as long as they're being somewhat serious, and tell you that Antonio Conte is a bad coach. He's a brilliant coach. I mean, throughout all the years, even when I've been Conte out when he was manager of Chelsea, I've always said that he's a brilliant football mind. And there's probably nobody better that in a short amount of time can get a team ready to be competitive. Because at the end of the day, this guy could take a bunch of Sunday league footballers and he could make them really hard to beat. He absolutely could. This is his strength. It's honing down right away, getting serious, and making his team hard to beat. So I'm not pleased, but I'm not surprised that Tottenham now have pulled it together. But I always see a ceiling for Conte. And I see a ceiling no matter where he is, just like I said, for him, because I'm just not sure if he has the attitude to be a long-term successful manager at a place. I also think after a while, his football sometimes gets figured out. But then whether I'm focusing on him or not, I always see a ceiling with Tottenham. And then when I see the combination of those two teams, I definitely see a ceiling. They've been famously a team that will only go so far for their manager. And Conte is that guy that if you only go so far for him, we know what will happen. But in the short term, no, I'm not at all surprised by this. Like I said, I don't like it because these days I'm a little bit more pessimistic on Chelsea truly contending for the Premier League title. So naturally then I'm just a little bit more worried about top four, even though that's the bare minimum of what I want. And we need a trophy this season one way or another, whether it's in the Premier League or not. So top four, it's still not even a victory, but top four has to happen. And Tottenham have obviously been good lately. They have some games in hand, and I don't want them catching up to us. And I know that in Conte's debut season or first two seasons with the club, his teams can be super competitive. So they could obviously catch up to us. I still think we're a better team, but this is exactly par for the course, in my opinion. And I'm not at all trying to like stick to my guns or anything. David, I think you know this has always been my take on Conte. Whether you want to call it a purple patch or not, that's not really the important part. It's just Conte's a short-term guy, but that short-term sometimes can be absolutely fantastic. So, I mean, look what he did. He came in right away. He goes through a back three. He, you know, gets a couple players who may not have been wingbacks before or just may not have been in the positions they are in now previously, and he gets players to buy in. And if you're not buying in, you're probably not going to play for him. So he's made Tottenham certainly his own. But like I said, if I'm wrong, I'll hold my hand up. I won't be too happy to, because it also means maybe it could be inconveniencing Chelsea. But if I'm wrong, I'll hold my hand up. But I'm pretty sure this is going to be a thing where they look pretty dangerous for a little while, maybe even get some big wins. Hopefully it's not against my Chelsea in the semifinals of the Carabao Cup. But it will fall off. It will fall off. It could be Conte's doing, could be Spurs doing, and it could be both. Probably will be both, David. So, yeah. I mean, are you surprised by my Conte take?
No, not at all. But I will say this. I always say that the best sign of respect you can give anyone is like fearing your opponent. Like I always say, no player terrified me more as an opponent than Brazilian Ronaldo. And that's kind of my definition of what I think is the best player that I've seen because nobody scared me more. And I do see, I can hear a little ting of fear in Conte with us Spurs catching up. So listen, I love Conte and I always say this. A lot of times we don't really argue on the facts. We're just arguing if we like someone or not, and then we'll take the facts that work. And I always say we hold people that we like to lower standards than those that we don't. And I've been thinking a lot about Conte and where he fits kind of in Italian managers. And let me begin by saying, like, the Italian tradition of managers is so long, and there are so many that when I say that one is an all-time great, and I do think that Conte is absolutely headed that way, it doesn't mean you're top five. Even being in a top 10 greatest Italian manager of all time is really saying a lot. And I think, if you don't like Conte, you're going to always pivot to A, one of the things that you said, the short-term thing, and then his struggles in Europe. But there's a couple of things that stand out to me when I think of Conte's legacy is that A, he really has never failed at any job yet. He's left his teams, look at how well Inter is doing and Juve. I think Chelsea, you can make a case that was a little bit different, but they still weren't horrible under Sarri by any means. But the thing that really also stands out to me a lot of time when we're talking about his failures in Europe, I think that's an absolutely fair statement. But I think when you are, if you're pointing that out and you're saying, well, Sacchi, Ancelotti, Lippi, Trapattoni, Capello, all these guys won in Europe. Okay, but I think it's also important to note that when those guys were competing in Europe, Italy had the best clubs, like by far. Like, yeah, were there some other good teams here or there? But basically, Italy was like the Premier League now. And I would say, in some ways, maybe even more dominant in some cases. And almost all those managers that won in Europe, the Italian managers that, when I say, oh, Conte is great, and then people bring up these guys, they went into those competitions in a lot of ways as the favorites to win it. Could Conte have done better in the Champions League? Absolutely. I'd be the first one to tell you that. And I think that's really the next step for him to really go to a whole other level. But I also do think it's a little bit unfair to say, well, Lippi, Ancelotti, Sacchi, Capello. You can poke holes in their resumes too. Like Sacchi only won one Scudetto, just one. And that Milan team was as good a team as I've ever seen at the club level. Like Ancelotti flopped at Juve. He was later in his career. He flopped at Napoli. Lippi flopped at Inter. Conte didn't win a title there. So I think the best case you can always make for Conte is like, look, so far he hasn't failed. He's left his clubs, in good shape. He's won everywhere he's gone, left the situation good. Does that count? Does that disqualify him from being compared to Sacchi because Sacchi's won Champions Leagues? Maybe. But I also think, sometimes we have this idealized version of these past managers, and it's also important to look at the context that we operate in. Okay, I'm glad we snuck in some Conte talk in our last pod before Christmas. So before we get to Napoli Outsider, we're going to do a part of the pod for our patron. If you enjoy listening to us, you can do a couple of things. You can follow us on Spotify, leave a review on iTunes, tweet about the pod, which we always really appreciate. Or you can also become a patron. You'll get an episode every Tuesday just for patrons. We're also going to do, we did our monthly special with Napoli Outsider, so there'll be an extra pod just with him, which we'll post today. And we answer all your questions. We also have some excellent articles, sometimes Enrico Passarella. This week, I'm going to write about the winners and losers of the first half of the season, and you'll be joining a community of great calcio fans. Okay, our last guest before Christmas is my dear friend, Napoli Outsider. I just want to make a note before you hear the interview. Because of the Christmas scheduling, it's been very hard to get everything in. We did record before the Napoli-Spezia game, which made parts of the interview sound, you know, not too great, especially the Juan Jesus part. But this is the nature of trying to record in these crazy times. But Napoli Outsider was awesome. And at the end, you'll also hear him talk a little bit about Vlahovic, and I think you'll really enjoy it. So I want to take this opportunity to also thank you all for listening to Pod throughout the year. Wish all of you and your families a Merry Christmas, and we'll be back even next week during the break with an episode. But Merry Christmas, Buon Natale to all, and thanks for your support. Okay, guys, before Serie A breaks and we take a little break around the holidays, I wanted to end things with a bang. So I brought back who I think is the best guest, not just on Calcio Land, but the best guest you'll hear on any Calcio podcast in English, my dear friend, the Napoli Outsider. So with him on the show, available to all, we'll chat about Napoli, and then him and I will go deep on the rest of Serie A, which will be heard by our patrons. So my dear friend, it's always a real pleasure to chat calcio with you. Bentornato to Calcio Land.
Thank you, and what a treat it is to be on your show. Thank you, Dave.
Okay, so just to give you guys some reference, we are recording this Tuesday right after Juve defeated Cagliari and Atalanta drew against Genoa. But on this part of the segment, we're going to chat Napoli. So let's start with this. What surprised you more, the win against Milan or the recent loss against Empoli when it came to Napoli?
Well, without a doubt, obviously, the loss with Empoli, because it doesn't matter how, you know, Napoli was shred to pieces, of course, but still, losing at home to Empoli and not scoring a goal, that's surprising. And even if you watch the game, you realize that it was kind of a, you know, it was kind of a strange game. Because Cutrone didn't even know he had scored when he scored, because the ball hit the back of his head. He didn't even know where it was going. At the same time, at the other end, Napoli hit the post twice. They had a goal rightly disallowed by VAR. I mean, it was very episodical. It was very, very strange. Whereas against Milan, I thought it was, you know, two similar teams in terms of strength, both with injury issues and both down in form. And, I mean, it could have gone either way, I guess, even though and this was before the game. Then watching the game, I saw that Napoli interpreted it better from the start and won it. But, I mean, winning it was within possibilities. Against Empoli, I thought that Napoli should not have lost. And it was borderline unthinkable, despite everything that had happened leading to that game. And it was, you know, basically that's probably the game I'm most bitter about, to be honest, because not only Napoli did play poorly, but, you know, there were certain situations in which luck did not favor it. But, you know what, usually luck favors those who deserve it. And in that game, Napoli did not deserve it. We have to be honest. In that sense, I thought Napoli deserved to lose. But, yeah, I mean, that would really surprise me.
Okay, so let's take more big picture. You've had a big sample size. You've had Spalletti's put his imprint on the team. Obviously, Napoli, like other teams, but Napoli have been really decimated by injuries. What grade would you give the team so far on December 21st?
Well, you know, tomorrow Napoli will play their last game of the first leg of games of this year. Hopefully they will win against Spezia. And in that case, they would end at 42 points, which is essentially, you know, an average to go 84. With 84 points in certain years, you can even win the league. And this is including a month and a half of injuries, endless injuries. So I think, I will not give them an A+. They certainly deserved an A+ through the end of October. But I think they still deserve an A-. They did make it through in the Europa League in a group that had Leicester. They are still, right now, as we speak, in second place in Serie A. So I think, you know, everything that we've seen, sure, the last month and a half make us feel a lot more bitter and disappointed seeing how things have set up. But, Napoli actually held through the injuries. and they're in a decent position to keep challenging for the title and certainly for Champions League spot in the new year. So that's all you could ask for before the season. So right now, I think an A- fits the bill.
Okay. And look, I know you're very Scaramantico, and we've talked quite a bit. I know deep down you have some regrets. And look, the season isn't over by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm with you. I think Napoli really, really had a good team. I remember when we were talking at the beginning of the season, them being 12-1 to win the Scudetto was just really incredible value. So I think that's a fair grade. So I want to ask you a little bit about Manolas, because, you know, I think to, especially to people that aren't Serie A junkies like you and I, who really follow the league closely, I think there was a lot of surprise for people that he left the way he did for a small transfer fee. And at a time that Napoli needs a lot of center backs, but I think anyone that's really paid a lot of attention to Napoli really doesn't see this as that big of a loss. So I got to ask you, and you and I have talked a lot about Napoli over the years, so let's take it from when Benitez arrived, because I feel like that's kind of the Napoli, the way we think of them now, that's when it started. Where do you rank Manolas as far as one of the worst moves of this period? Because he was very expensive, all things considered, and Napoli really didn't get that much from him.
Yeah, you're right. You're right, absolutely. But I think he was he was more of a disappointment as opposed to a financial mistake. And here's the reason, because Napoli actually ended up including Diawara in the deal. So even though Manolas did cost a lot, he ended up costing something like Diawara plus 15 million, which is still substantial. But when you think that Diawara didn't give anything to Roma, I mean, he might have been even worse in terms of production. You know, it was basically not as expensive as you could think of it. That being said, you know, what really upsets me was that Manolas did have some good spells with Napoli, and his partnership with Koulibaly had some really promising moments. The problem is that they were never healthy at the same time, essentially. And this before January of this year. Until January of this year, the main issue was that they were not healthy at the same time. So there was always somebody else playing at the back, and things didn't really work out. I felt that Manolas actually had some of his best games in the worst periods of Napoli, under the mutiny period with Ancelotti, and in some games again with Gattuso. But then when the calendar turned to 2021, Gattuso was still there. I mean, it was clear that Manolas just quit on the team. He just flat out did. You know, all these phantom injuries started popping up. And when he was on the pitch, he started playing a lot worse. I mean, one of the situations that I clearly remember was the game against Sassuolo last year. Gattuso sent him on, like, in the very final minutes for whatever reason, because he was on the bench. He had just recovered from an apparent very light injury. And Gattuso sent him on, and he came on and carelessly gave away a penalty in the 94th minute. Napoli lost 2 points, which were essentially, you know, as key as the points that were lost against Verona for losing the Champions League spot. And Manolas didn't really care throughout. Then the whole summer there were voices of him wanting to leave. Then the season starts, he plays carelessly once again. He gives up an absurd goal to Morata against Juventus and then gets benched. After that, it's been phantom injury after phantom injury. And when he recovered, like for the last couple of games, like the morning of one of his last games, he had like something like a stomach ache or whatever, some kind of a very light ailment that did not allow him to play. So it was obvious he wanted to leave, and it had been obvious for a while. But I thought it was just as unprofessional as it could have been. That being said, you know, I would separate his performance in the last year from the performance that was there previously. I think that all in all, he was definitely a disappointment. But, you know, it was a story of two different types of disappointment. Before 2021, the most disappointing part was that I felt we wasted some of his best games due to the team setup, due to whatever was happening, and due to Koulibaly actually missing quite a few games. Whereas in 2021, the disappointment is strictly correlated to Manolas, to his non-existing professionalism to his behavior, to the way he left, and to the way he literally abandoned Napoli. Because you are right, what we've seen in the last year is not a great loss. In fact, what we've seen in the last year is, you know, better he leaves than stays, because Napoli are going to save some money.
The wages him away. Were huge, yeah.
The wages were huge, and he was being unprofessional. So it's not that big a loss at all right now. And anybody who arrives is probably going to do better just by actually making himself available, which Manolas was not. And the most disappointing part, if possible, was the fact that when he got to Athens, the first thing he said was that he's fully healthy. And he's glad to be there right now because he's fully healthy and didn't want to get there later when he was going to be maybe hurt or old. So he was clearly clearly withdrawing from the team. I just cannot believe that somebody can be that unprofessional, but apparently they can. So yes, he was a disaster. All of this said, he was one of the biggest disappointments because we were expecting great things out of him. But I think there's one guy that just cannot be reached in the last few years. It's a guy that I didn't like, but I remember that Napoli, I mean, they made such a big fuss for getting him. They followed him for many months. Then they got him, and he was a Simone Verdi. He was such a bad purchase. And if you think about the fact that Manolas did cost Diawara plus 15, Simone Verdi actually cost 25. And I think it was borderline of a miracle to be able to resell him for 25 to Torino the following year. And, of course, he's been too poor even for Torino standards.
Yeah.
And not this year's Torino version, which is pretty good, but like last year's Torino version, which wasn't even good. So I think that Verdi is probably the number one. But surely Manolas does rank very, very high in this ranking, for sure.
Yeah, no, and it's a good point on the transaction, the Diarra piece. That seems, you know, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So let's talk a little bit about Juan Jesus, who, you know, Mourinho said that he misses him at Roma, but I think a lot of people found that pretty funny. I think he's probably one of the players with one of the worst reputations in the league, but he is a player that Spalletti knows well. I actually think he's been pretty useful to Napoli, somewhat surprising. Maybe it's the Spalletti influence there. So what do you make of his performances so far?
Unbelievable. I mean, that's all you can ask for from the last guy on the bench in defense, because that's what he came for. He was there as a substitute for Mario Rui. He was there as the fourth central defender. So behind Manolas, behind Koulibaly, behind Rahmani. And he's been incredible. I mean, obviously, he's made some minor mistakes, but he's been professional. He's played well wherever he's been employed. And you couldn't ask for more, really. And he's given also a veteran presence. I think, I was actually kind of skeptical when he arrived. The only thing that I was happy about was that he had Serie A experience, and he got some really low wages. But other than that, you know, I mean, this is a guy that hadn't really played much in the last periods, and even when he did play, he wasn't really that good. But apparently Spalletti knows him better than anybody else and got the best out of him. Against Milan, he was just unbelievable, for example, but it's not the only game in which he played well. So, you know, he went way far above and beyond any expectation. But I have to say, this has happened with a lot of Napoli players. And when this happens to a lot of players at the same time, it's kind of like the Milan situation. You have to say that the trainer, the coach, has made a difference. Because when one guy just comes out of nowhere, well, it's him. When a whole team improves, both individually and as a team, that's the coach. And in fact, with Spalletti, it's easier to say who hasn't performed. And they almost all have excuses. For example, Lozano hasn't been as good, but Lozano skipped the whole preparation, the whole retreat, because he had broken every bone in his face with his national team. So, you know, he's starting to get into form right now. Demme got hurt during the retreat, then he came back, he got COVID, and then he came back, and he never got into form. And finally, Insigne. Now, once you take out these three guys, everybody else, and Manolas, of course, yeah, well, that's a different thing. But once you take out these guys, everybody else has improved from last year. And it's impressive the way they have improved. Another guy is Elmas, Rahmani. I mean, Rahmani would, Gattuso couldn't even play. Right now, he's actually one of the best center backs in Italy. I mean, if Napoli have the best defense in Serie A, and it's because they have Rahmani and Juan Jesus now, because Koulibaly has been out for a while. It's incredible what Spalletti has done with these guys, but I think it also speaks of the professionalism of guys like Juan Jesus and Rahmani, to, you know, being able to sit on the bench for a long time, and when they got their chance, they've used it. And they've been professional, which is something that Napoli have lacked in the last 2 or 3 years, to be honest. That's the biggest critique I can make to Napoli's squad, is that they really haven't, they never shine in professionalism, but these guys do. And I think that Juan Jesus has been impressive. Impressive. I'm so happy we got him now, because, you know, you couldn't do better than that. I don't think that there is a guy better than that, like as a bottom of the bench defender in Serie A, that can just step up and keep clean sheets against Milan. I mean, that's just great. Too much enthusiasm here, huh?
Yeah, so despite Juan Jesus, who's been playing really well, and I appreciate you highlighting that, as it sounds now, the Africa Cup is slated to happen. Koulibaly, when he gets healthy, is supposed to go there. So I think Napoli probably needs another player in that area. Do you agree? What type of profiles do you think Napoli is going to go after? And if you could pick the ideal addition for Napoli's defense, who would it be and why?
Well, Napoli definitely need a guy, definitely, even just for numerical purposes. They only have three center backs right now, and Koulibaly is going to miss at least one more month due to the African Cup, which is incredible that Napoli actually missed Koulibaly, Osimhen, and Anguissa for all this period. It was like an appetizer to the Africa Cup. I mean, it's just too much. But the thing is, Napoli right now, as we speak, they only have two central defenders, and Rahmani has been for 2 weeks now one yellow away from a suspension, which would have left Juan Jesus as the only center back available for selection. So Napoli absolutely critically need another one. There have been some names going around, but most of them are absolutely unrealistic and especially unmotivated. It just shows that they don't know, the guys making those names, what Napoli are looking for. But Giuntoli actually did say that Napoli are looking for a right-footed center back, which makes a lot of sense because Koulibaly plays on the left, Juan Jesus plays on the left. Rahmani is the only guy that, as a natural guy, plays on the right now. And he can also play on the left, by the way. So they absolutely need a right-footed center back, and that's the most important thing. My dream addition would absolutely be Bremer from Torino. I think Bremer would be excellent, both because of a combination of characteristics, skills, age, and experience in Serie A. But if they want to get somebody else, I'm okay with that as well, as long as you know, he's got a high potential, because you can decide to keep rolling the whole rest of the season with Rahmani and Koulibaly partnering as center backs, but you need the young talent to come up. So either you go for a guy like Bremer, or you go for a young center back that needs to mature throughout the years. For example, Viti from Empoli is a guy that's been mentioned. Gatti from Frosinone has been mentioned. I think there are a bunch more from foreign leagues. But if you're looking for a starter caliber guy, I think you can't get anything better than Bremer at this point.
Fair. So you mentioned Elmas a second ago, and he's definitely been pretty impressive under Spalletti. Napoli spent also a decent amount to sign Lobotka not that long ago. That's a player they've been trying to get something out of. So let me ask you, between these two players, Elmas and Lobotka, who do you expect more from in the second half of the season?
You know, Lobotka, he's an interesting player, because in his first season with Celta Vigo, I remember him distinctly. He was one of the best midfielders in the whole Spanish league. And he was impressive. He was incredible. But then he tailed off. Napoli still decided to go for him. They still purchased him. And he kept tailing off. It looked like that one season was just like just like a random season that had happened, not a real reflection of his talent. But now that he's playing with Spalletti, he literally looks like David Pizarro. And he's just like a reincarnation of Pizarro in front of the defense. And he's been excellent. That being said, I still would pick Elmas because Elmas is 22 years old. And for a while, we've been waiting for something from him. But, you know, he was falling into that kind of player who was very versatile. He was kind of good at everything, but excellent at nothing. And the problem with that was that he wasn't specializing at anything. So he was getting used here, you know, as a mezzala, as a central midfielder, behind the strikers, on the wings, wherever he was being used. But he wasn't making a difference anyway, and he wasn't progressing. Now, this year, his versatility actually was used by Spalletti to make him a literal substitute of Insigne, but also a tactical pawn to move around the checkboard. And the thing is, I really think that he's coming into his own. He's starting to score goals. You've seen the one against Milan. And at this point, I expect him to take that extra step that's going to propel him forward. Lobotka, at best, would have to bounce back to previously shown levels, and I think he will. But there's also another point. The point is that if Napoli play at their full strength, they're going to have Fabian Ruiz playing instead of Lobotka. No matter how well Lobotka plays, Fabian Ruiz is better. So he's going to be the starter. Whereas Elmas, if he keeps going this way, he could literally overtake Insigne. In fact, as of now, I don't think there's any argument that Elmas has been a better player than Insigne in this season. Insigne has zero open play goals in Serie A this year. So, I mean, obviously, in the grand scheme of things, he's better and he's got to be an important contributor. But as of now, Elmas has been better. So that's why I would have to pick him. You know, age, talent, and performance go his way.
So we mentioned earlier expensive purchases by Napoli. I'm glad you mentioned Verde. I was trying to figure out who you were talking about. But there may be another player that we might be adding to this list in the near future. And this is Alex Mire. He was a very highly rated young goalkeeper, arrived at Napoli for a huge fee. But, you know, Spina has been the clear starter this season. I just looked it up. Mire is going to turn 25 next year, which really was kind of surprising to me. Do you see him as having a future at Napoli, or do you think it's kind of a fait accompli? He's going to have to try to become a starter somewhere else?
Yeah, I think at this point he needs a change of scenery. I think this was his last chance, and this time, you know, he just wasn't lucky. With Gattuso decided to go with the expert guy in goal, but this year he just had bad luck. I mean, he started the season as the undisputed starter, got hurt, and Ospina has been one of the best goalkeepers in Europe. And this is not a joke. I mean, he's second in Europe for clean sheets, Ospina, behind Ederson from Manchester City. So, I mean, as much as you can love Meret, the point is that if you've got this guy who's got the second highest number of clean sheets in Europe, you stick with him. You don't fix what is not broken. And Ospina at present is playing so well that it makes no sense to take him off. You've got to think about the team first. So, you know, it was bad luck for Meret, but it just happened. And also, with Ospina, Napoli do have the best defense in Serie A. So I don't think that in this season there's any fault by Meret. I don't think he did anything wrong. It's just that his rival is having a great season, and you got to respect that. But the problem is that at this point, Meret has been the substitute now for 2 years running, and I think that a lot of fans actually have hated him in Naples. And I know this is going to sound weird to non-Neapolitan fans, but, you know, most of the guys that were brought on by Ancelotti, this includes Lozano, and it has included Di Lorenzo, are very hated by a certain portion of fans, usually fans of Sarri. Because it was like, I mean, it's ridiculous, but like Napoli fandom like fractions itself when Sarri left. And some of them were more fans of Sarri than Napoli, and some of them, and those guys weren't really happy with Ancelotti from the beginning, and they opposed him, and they opposed even his purchases. So that included Fabian Ruiz, included Di Lorenzo, it included Lozano. You have no idea how much hate Lozano is getting from those kinds of fans. And the same went for the others. And so Meret is one of those. And I think that at this point, it's best for him if he just leaves and gets a clean slate somewhere else where he can get a chance. But I think right now, Napoli are going with Ospina. And even though he's old, he's performing. So it's just fair that it's like that. And I think if Ospina got back to the bench and Meret got a string of starts, and, for example, he allowed a couple of goals maybe, I mean, that would be even worse for everybody, for the team, for Meret himself, and so on. Because at this point, even if Meret played great, he wouldn't perform as an upgrade over Ospina's present performances. So there's absolutely no point in changing things around.
So you mentioned Insigne a minute ago. His contract is going to expire in June. There's been reports Napoli are looking at least cut the base pay of his salary. I know I've asked you this the last time you were on. Has your opinion changed? Do you think he's more likely to resign, less likely to resign? And ultimately, what do you think happens?
Let's take this one step at a time. I still think that there's nobody that's going to offer a better package than Napoli. And by package, I mean there's nobody no team that is better than Napoli that will offer him more than Napoli and that will guarantee him a starting spot like the one he has in Napoli. Which means that essentially the best thing for him is to stay at Naples. But I also think he's got no real concrete offer in his hands. And you see that by the way his agent has acted. I don't think you've heard a single word from the agents of Brozovic, Perisic, Kessié, Dybala, and so on. Those guys have been doing their thing, in the dark because they know they've got other offers. They're going to decide whatever they're going to do. But in the case of Insigne, his agent started shouting, we've got to find a solution by January, otherwise we're going to do whatever we're going to do, and so on and so on. If he really had such a solid plan B behind, he would just keep quiet and see how things go with Napoli, because in the meantime, he's got a plan B. If he wants to force the hands of Naples, of Napoli, so hard, that probably means he doesn't have that plan B behind him. But aside from this, the problem is Insigne has not performed, and he hasn't been a leader once again. I mean, he's gone up and down with this leadership role. I think it's just a little too big for him. There are some periods in which he really shows that he can be a leader, and then there are some periods in which he just puts himself in front of everybody and everything else. And this is one of those times that once again. The problem is that if you want to act like that, you got to play like that. Insigne this year has been atrocious. He's been abysmal, to be honest, and not in terms of effort. He does put the effort, but he's just not putting the quality. If you want that kind of money, and he's 30, he's going to be 31 in June, so we're going to have to pay for his decline years, obviously. But sometimes you do that. For example, for Mertens, Napoli did that. Yeah, but think, just even Napoli is going to do that for Mertens. So it's a fair proposition that he wants to get paid. But if he wants to get paid, he's got to perform like it. Once again, he's got 0 goals from open play this year in Serie A. That's terrible. It's just terrible. And he hasn't, not just hasn't made a difference, he's been outplayed by his reserves. So this is too much to disregard. And so he's got to do better. That being said, I still think there's a chance that he resigns. But, with his agent speaking like that, and with Insigne himself posting some ridiculous Instagram stories this week about his own professionalism, I think that, they might actually end up clashing and not signing just out of spite, even without having a solid plan B behind, because that's the kind of things they might end up doing. It's personalities like Insigne and De Laurentiis might end up clashing just by virtue of how they are. But that makes a whole difference, like the way his agent or the way he has acted as opposed to those other guys whose contracts are going to expire next summer and who haven't spoken a single word. Now, again, I think Napoli's offer isn't all that low. And his agent, when he spoke about it, actually said that his problem is that De Laurentiis wants to lower the base offer and improve the bonuses. So basically, the big problem is that Insigne wants a higher base. He wants guaranteed money, whereas De Laurentiis wants to make sure that he gets paid, Insigne gets paid, only if the goals are obtained. You know, he wants to avoid that Napoli don't go in the Champions League, and he's still getting a Champions League caliber salary. That's the part they want to avoid. And I think that's fair. That's fair, not just in a post-COVID situation, but just in general. And his agent thinks it's not fair. And we'll see, we'll see. I mean, at this point, to be honest, I hope they do reach an agreement. But if this is the way Insigne is going to perform, then he's actually going to make it simpler to part ways with him. And I don't think he's doing himself a favor in looking for a new contract, because if this is the way he's going to play, you know, other teams are going to notice the way he's going to play.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I really do think all the MLS rumors are, you know, pretty desperate attempts to gain leverage for sure. So before we transition to our patron part of the podcast, I do want to ask you a non-Napoli question, and this is a great opportunity for you to take a big victory lap, because you were one of the first two people that was really, really high on Vlahovic. You and Enrico Passarello also contributes to our patron page. Like, beginning of last season, both you guys were like, this guy's amazing. You've come on the podcast many times. You've told us how wonderful he is, and he's been outstanding. Now, I'm not sure if you are familiar with this, but, you know, I work with Alex, the co-host of the show. You know, he's big in the Premier League world. And there's a lot of people, Premier League fans, when they hear about how great Vlahovic is and that he could be this great striker on a team. I've had people, and even Alex has asked me this, oh, is he any different than Belotti when he had that great season and then Torino gave him the contract with the 100 million exit clause, which was to keep him. It wasn't because they thought he was worth that. And look, I like Belotti. I thought that year or two where he was really outstanding. I think he's been a very good player since. I don't think Torino stay in Serie A last season without him. But in my mind, I mean, Vlahovic is a whole other level. I'm sure you agree. So let me simply ask you this. What would you tell a Premier League fan who brings up Belotti as a reason to be skeptical about Vlahovic?
Well, I would tell them that they just don't watch Serie A. I mean, that's just somebody, that's a comment made by somebody who does not watch the league, probably doesn't even watch highlights, but let's just assume they do. And the whole comparison is just based on the fact that they've scored a lot of goals in 1 year. And that's it, literally that's it. But, I mean, if you just look at the player, you'll see a huge difference. Now, we can go statistically, for example, because only two guys in the history of Serie A have scored more than Vlahovic in a solo year, okay? Only two in the whole history of Serie A, and one was Borel in the 1930s, and one was Gunnar Nordahl for Milan in the 1950s. That's it. That's it. The third best guy in a solo year was Ronaldo, and he's been tied by Vlahovic, who had many fewer penalties. And of course, Vlahovic, no offense to Fiorentina fans, but he plays for Fiorentina, okay? He plays for Fiorentina. And not even this year's Fiorentina, because for the first 6 months, he played for another type of Fiorentina, okay? We got to put this into consideration. And this is just the statistical side. But if you just look at him, this guy is actually closer to Haaland than he is to Belotti, okay? I'm not saying that he's as good as Haaland, but he's much closer than people would think. This guy is a natural goal scorer. He's strong in the air. He's strong with his feet. He's intelligent. You know, there is even like a small component of Inzaghi in him when he's in the goalkeeper's box, where it looks like the ball looks for him, you know? He's there, and somehow the ball ends up with him. And he's good at scoring with one touch, you know, from outside the box with his head. He scores in every possible way. Yes, there are some holes in his game. And physically, for example, he's not as strong as Haaland, but I think his left foot is just as good. I mean, this guy, you put this guy with in a team like Manchester City, which, by the way, I think would be the favorites to land him in the summer. You put this guy in a team like Manchester City. I mean, this guy is going to score at least 25 right away in the Premier League. I mean, it's so much different from Belotti. Belotti was obviously having a great season, and sure, I didn't expect him to end up this bad immediately. But there's a difference. You know, when you see a guy like Belotti who doesn't have the greatest technique, you know, what's the best attribute with Belotti? Probably his work rate. And it's definitely not technique. It's probably, I don't know, maybe his heading skills. I don't know. I wouldn't even know what to say. It was obvious that Belotti could have at most been a backup in a top team or a starter on the teams right behind the top one, probably like Immobile himself. That at the very best. But in the case of Vlahović, he's a difference maker. He might be the best player in Serie A currently. It's just, I mean, people who say that, and again, no offense to them, they just haven't watched. It sounds like one of those comments that some English pundits make, you know, when, you know, could Messi do it on a wet Tuesday night in Stoke? Come on, dudes. I mean, be better. I know that the English Premier League is the best league in the world, and there's no disputing that. But it's not like those other leagues are farmer leagues. I mean, you've seen just Napoli take out Leicester a couple of weeks ago, right? I mean, what do you think? They probably, if they say something like that, they're essentially saying that Jamie Vardy is a lot better than Vlahović, obviously, if they compare him to Belotti. That's just not the case. Just watch a game or two, look at what Vlahović does, look at the way he plays in the last 25 yards of the pitch, and you're going to see just a great, great striker. You know, there are comparisons that are more apt with him. I'm not saying that he's as good as Holland, as I said. He's definitely not as good as Van Basten. But there are components of those players in him. There is something about the elegance, the character, the personality, the smarts, the way he's complete. I mean, it's just incredible. And again, as much as I love Osimhen, you know I've picked Vlahović ahead of him in the season. You know I've picked Vlahović ahead of Lautaro Martinez. You know, it's because he's that kind of guy. He's a generational guy, and you got to realize that. Right now, probably, you know, Mbappe just turned 23, okay? And guys younger than 23, there's literally only Holland in the world that I would take above Vlahović right now. So, no, just watch the games, and that's it. That's the only thing I can say.
Yeah, I love the Van Basten thing that you mentioned, because I do have to say, and maybe it's the body type and similar elegance, but Vlahović reminds me of Van Basten a lot more than Batistuta, and I know the Fiorentina connection there. So great stuff. If you guys enjoyed this segment, consider becoming a patron. You'll hear once a month Napoli Outsider, and I go into Serie A as well.